Hope you're having a wonderful day. So, I wanted to talk about so many different things tonight, but let me see if I could just kind of get it down to some of the ideas. I saw recently on YouTube this video of a religious man in Morocco attacking Arabs for wanting to boycott goods manufactured and sold by Jews. And he says in this video, if you boycott everything made by Jews, you'll go around naked and starving. And I think there's a real truth to it. So he lists there a number of examples of goods that were created by Jews, starting with jeans, which were invented by a Jew named Levi Strauss in 1878. Go ahead, he says, and just try and tell your kids to stop wearing jeans. The second example he brings is lipstick. Lipstick, as it turns out, was invented by a Jew named Marcus Levy in 1915. And he mentions the ballpoint pen, which was invented in 1938 by a Jew named Lazio Biro. And the guy says in the video, "Why are you using ballpoint pens? Just use a feather like they used to." Or remote control devices. Those things that we use in all household appliances. They're invented by Robert Adler, a Jew, that in 1950, or the pacemaker, invented by a Jew named Paul Zoll in 1952. And the guy says, all the more so, let's see how long you'd last without a pacemaker. And he goes on listing more and more and more things. And then he talks about the fact that Jews have won some 184 Nobel Prizes when there were a total population of a little bit over 13 million worldwide. And the Arabs, he says, consist of 1.4 billion people, yet only 9 Arabs ever won a Nobel Prize. Now, for an Arab man to talk the truth, that's fine and good. But all of a sudden, when you hear a Jew saying things like this, that we're the smartest and the sharpest, and that we're the ones responsible for so much technological innovation, I'm not sure that doing that actually brings people to love Jews. Actually, probably when you were listening to me say that before, you're like, why is another Jew here talking about all the great things that Jews have accomplished? And I think that there's a lot of people who would argue that this causes more anti-Semitism because it arouses jealousy. This week's Haftorah concludes with the timeless words of Jeremiah. Jeremiah says in the name of God, the wise man shall not praise himself because of his wisdom, the strong man because of his strength, nor the rich man because of his money. Rather, if a person wishes to praise himself, let it be through understanding, knowing me, that I am God. So maybe instead of being boastful, we can stress another point about our gifts to the world that maybe will bring us a little more respect from the world. What I think needs to be emphasized is not what the Jews gave the world, but what Judaism, what the Jewish people as a whole gave them, what Torah values we presented to humanity. Maybe that's a conversation that would be a little differently acknowledged. So just Sunday on Purim, we read in the Megillah how Haman came to King Ahasuerus to convince him to annihilate, to kill and destroy all the Jews. And the Talmud tells us that Haman said to the king that he wanted to do so because they're always telling everyone it's Shabbat today, it's Passover today, we're not allowed to work. This is one of the reasons that Talmud gives, that literally the Jews are going around saying to people, oh, it's Shabbat today, you can't work. What the Talmud there is saying is that Haman was claiming that the Jews were always taking off for religious days, for holidays, for Shabbat, for Passover. But what's so bad about people who don't work on Shabbat? There are other religions that have a day of rest. What's so unique about the Jewish people taking off for Shabbat? Not only that, but in Western society today, at least in the United States and Canada, there isn't just one day of rest, but today there's two. So what's Haman so upset about? Here's the interesting thing. If you take a look at, let's say, the Gregorian calendar, there's 365 1/4 days. You take a look at the lunar calendar, you're going to see there is 12 equal months. But where is the origin of the leap? Where did the leap come from? Well, Napoleon actually was one of those who thought about the leap differently than others. He said, the leap, I know its origin, and the Nouvelle France, the whole idea of Napoleon was to uproot religion. And so part of uprooting religion, what he said is, why do we need 7 days in a week? Let's make a metric week. That'll be interesting. That makes more sense. Well, I have a secret for you. That metric week lasted for a little under 13 years. People couldn't handle it. So the only origin for the 7-day week is the Torah. God created the world in 6 days and rested on the seventh. That is the only origin for the week. People, religious, secular, all over the world, never questioned the week when the only origin of it is the Torah. And at the time, let's talk about, let's say, the time of Ahasuerus and Haman, for example, the concept of a day of rest was not widely accepted. Even much later in the Persian Empire, during the heyday of the Greek Empire, and even under the Roman Empire, there was no such thing as a day of rest. They said these people are lazy. They want to rest. They're lazy. These civilizations, they would laugh and they would belittle the Jewish people for not working on Shabbat. They argued that these lazy people and that the day of rest causes deterioration and a loss of productivity. It took so many generations for the world to come around to understand what a wonderful gift the Torah gave to the world, the Jews gave to the world, the gift of Shabbat. There's various gifts that we've given to the world that we don't get credit for, but this is one of them. So if anyone ever comes to you and says about the Jewish people and the gifts and all their things, just say, just thank us for your weekends. That's all we want. Just thank us for your weekends. At the beginning of the Megillah on Purim, we read how Ahasuerus wanted his wife, Queen Vashti, to come before him wearing her royal crown, so the royal court and all its guests could see how beautiful she was. And perhaps rightfully so, she refused. And the king turned to his advisors and said, and what do we do with a queen that disobeys the king? And there was an advisor, his name was Memuchan, actually it was Haman. He told the king that the queen must be impeached from her royal position, since she was a bad example to the women of the kingdom. Because from the queen's word, he says, will go forth upon all the women to disgrace their husbands and their eyes. Meaning that all the women in the Persian Empire will take their cue from Vashti and start disrespecting their men. And so Memuchan, this Haman, argued that we have to punish Vashti so that all the women will give respect to their husbands from great to small. Now, let's take a look at the way the Torah looks at the relationship between a married man and woman. Let's take a look at Abraham. The first time we read about an argument between a husband and wife in the Torah is when Sarah asks Abraham to banish the maidservant and her son. And the Torah tells us, and the matter seemed very bad in the eyes of Abraham. And then God intervenes in this agreement and says, everything that Sarah says to you, listen to her voice. My wife Sarah likes to remind me of that. The Torah says, everything that Sarah says to you, listen to her voice. So in the first dispute between husband and wife in the Torah, God takes the woman's side. This is before women's rights. With Yitzchak, with Isaac, at the engagement of Isaac and Rebekah, we read how the family left the decision whether or not to get engaged to Isaac in Rebekah's hands. They said, it says there, let us call the maiden and ask what she says. To that verse, the great commentary Rashi adds, from here we learn that you do not take a woman in marriage without her knowledge. This is before women's rights. This is Rashi talking about the Torah, saying that we learn from this that a woman cannot get married against her will or against her knowledge. To this day, there are places in the world where young girls are forced into marriage against their will. But the Torah, over 4,000 years ago, established that it's forbidden to marry a woman if she doesn't want to get married. With Jacob, when he lived in his uncle Laban's house, God came to him and said, return to the land of your fathers and to your birthplace, and I shall be with you. God himself commanded him to return to the land of Israel. But before Jacob even took a single step, he called in his wives, Rachel and Leah, and told them that God had commanded him to return to the Holy Land. And only after Rachel and Leah gave their consent, which they said, all that God said to you, you do. Only then did Jacob leave Padan Aram and go to the Holy Land. And we even see when God gave the Torah, he sent Moshe first to speak to the women. He says, thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, which refers to the woman, and speak to the sons of Israel. God first requested the women's agreement, and only then did he turn to the men. So this idea that women have an equal say to men, and that you need to respect a woman's say, didn't exist amongst other nations until very, very recent in history. Who created this line of thinking that we have to respect the woman? Similar to the Torah inventing the weekend, the Torah invented this idea as well. I don't think there's another source that's earlier, and you can debate me on it, and you can go find another source, but I don't think there's another source that's earlier than the Torah that talks about women's rights. When did the enlightened world come to the conclusion that having slaves is a bankrupt idea? It's only about a little less than 150 years ago. Until then, even in the United States, the freedom of millions was negated. America even needed a civil war to change that. In the Torah, right after the Exodus from Egypt, God takes the Jews out of what is called the house of slaves. They were slaves in Egypt. And God commands the Jews in the Torah that it is forbidden for a man to take a slave against his will. One who steals a man and sells him shall surely be put to death. But that's exactly what slavery was. Over all the years, over all the decades, over all the centuries, that slavery was commonly accepted. And it was a normal practice in the world. Slave dealers would kidnap people in Africa and sell them in America. This was normal. But more than that, even a man who willingly sells himself as a slave must go free after 6 years, according to Torah law. Because the Torah doesn't want people to be slaves for life. And the Torah said this over 3,000 years ago, before we had the eyes that we have today, and it became obvious to us. Let's talk about monogamy, for example. Having only one lawfully wedded wife is something that even today is only accepted in Western countries. In the Arab world, to this day, men marry more than one woman. But even at the beginning of the book of Genesis, the Torah tells us, therefore let a man abandon his father and mother and cleave to his wife and be one flesh. Now, it's true, and you'll say this, that the Torah doesn't forbid marrying more than one woman. But this verse gives us, I think, the Torah's more theological perspective. And we see that this is how our patriarchs actually lived. Abraham was married to one woman, and he lived with her for decades. It was only when he saw that he couldn't have kids that she advised that he marry Hagar, the maidservant, and so that Hagar can function as sort of a surrogate mother for her to give birth to a baby. But who was and remained Avram's wife forever was Sarah. And so the very moment things didn't work out, Hagar is kicked out of the house by Sarah. What's more is Isaac, who had children from Rebekah, never married any other woman. As for Jacob, well, we all know the love of his life was Rachel. At the end, even though his father-in-law tricked him, and it turned out that he also married Leah. And when Rachel saw that she was not going to be able to bring forth children at all, she followed in the footsteps of her grandmother and presented her maidservant to Yaakov as well. Leah did the same thing. And so it turned out that it's true that Yaakov was married to four women, but his true love, and it became an issue, a real issue in the marriage, is that her true love was really Rachel, was really Rachel. And with Moses as well, only marrying Zipporah, and Aaron, who was married to just one woman. And what's more is, as a general rule, with the high priest, with the Kohen Gadol in the temple, was the Kohen Gadol couldn't be married to more than one woman. So, what do I say here? What's the message of this week's Torah portion? What's the message of the gifts of the Jews?
We'll be back after a quick break.
Are you tired of swiping right on every dating app out there and still getting nowhere?
Are you convinced that you'll forever be alone, surrounded by nothing but cats and empty takeout containers?
Hi, I'm Aliza Ben-Shalom, the host of the new show, Jewish Matchmaking, which you can find on Netflix.
And I'm the Love Rabbi, Rabbi Yisrael Bernath, and we're inviting you to join us for Matchmaker Matchmaker.
Each week, we'll answer one of your pressing relationship questions, from how to get over your ex to how to deal with your partner's annoying habits.
So if you're ready to laugh, cry, or maybe even find love, then tune in to Matchmaker Matchmaker, and it's available now wherever you listen to your podcasts. I want to leave for today. We could talk about it a different day. But for today, I want to leave with the Jews have contributed to the world, to the non-Jews to count. Let them tell us that. They're very good at that. The verse says, may the stranger praise you and not your mouth. Let them tell us about all the Nobel Prizes. We shouldn't be talking about that. Our mission in this world is to tell the world not what the Jews have contributed to the world, but what Judaism, what our Torah has contributed to the world, how the Torah influenced the values and the behaviors of every nation on earth, how the Torah has given gifts to the world. So many of them we don't get credit for. So many of them have been adopted by other cultures and religions. And today it's like obvious. I mean, who would question the weekend today when we were called lazy for having a weekend? Who would question the idea of monogamy today, well, at least in the Western world, when we were considered something of revolutionary with monogamy? These are gifts. And I would say even amongst that, the gift of marriage. The gift of marriage being a holy act, right? Somebody who's not religious, who never saw a rabbi or a priest or an imam their whole life, all of a sudden goes running to a rabbi to get married or to a priest to get married. Why? Because it's considered a sacred act. Just the idea of sacred, of something being holy, that a mundane task, a mundane idea in this world, something physical in this world can be holy. That we can take physical things, earth, and elevate it and make it holy, that is a uniquely Torah idea. It didn't happen before the Torah was given, but once the Torah was given, that changed everything. And heaven came down to earth, and earth went up to heaven, and things that we can now take a book that is made of wood and made of soil, and we can make that holy. It becomes something that is sacred. That's a beautiful idea. Shabbat. There are so many traditions that elevate space. I remember a priest once asking me how we elevate our space. And I said, we don't elevate space. We elevate time. That's what's holy to us. Right? You can go into an airport on any given morning. If there's enough Jews around, you're going to see them forming a minion in the middle of the airport. You'll see a minion in Disneyland if there's enough Jews there. Because we can pray anywhere. We just have to pray at the right time. I never walked into an airport one Sunday morning and saw just a bunch of people just kind of sitting there in the middle of the lobby having mass. Because to have mass, you have to have a space that you can have mass in. To pray, we don't elevate space, we elevate time. And that idea of elevating time, I think, is that all we have in our lives is time. All we have is time and space. We are limited to time and space. And so today, I think instead of talking about all of the obvious things that so many Jews talk about and perhaps things that embolden the anti-Semites, or I don't like the word anti-Semite, by the way, the anti-Jewish hatred. I think we could talk about the gifts that we've given the world that maybe they don't appreciate that it came from us. We gave them the Judeo-Christian value system. Well, the judicial system, which is Judeo-Christian. What came first, Christian or Judeo? That's obvious. And so we know what we gave the world. And there's so much hatred. I've been talking about this so much, but I'm going to say it again. The one wish I have for the world today is independent critical thinking. There is way too much groupthink. Way too many people are just repeating rhetoric. Repeating literally messages that are coming out. Who knows if they're true or not true, without even fact-checking or even knowing what's really going on. What I wish is something that the Jewish people have done so well over the years, so for so many centuries, and that is the gift of independent and critical thinking. In just under a month, Jews all over the world are going to sit at the Passover Seder. The Passover Seder is supposed to be a typical night in a Jewish home. That's the point of it. It's a typical night. The Jews get together, And this is what they do. And what is the entire Seder about? What is the entire function of a Seder? Asking questions, right? Asking questions. Getting the kids to ask questions. That's the entire function of the Seder. The entire function of the Seder is critical independent thought. It's for us to train the children to think for themselves. I think that if we just focus on this, if we ask for one thing and one thing only in this world that's full of so much groupthink, it's a Passover Seder. Ask questions. Ask and ask and ask. Teach the kids to ask, because only that way are they going to be able to start developing their own ideas and see through some of the absolute ludicrous ideas of the world. So often, that people ask me, what do I do? Somebody came to me and they were talking about, you know, this pro-Palestinian rhetoric, groupthink, not independent thought. What do I do? How do I answer it? And I said, just create space. Don't answer it. Just allow them to speak. Because somebody who never thought for themselves, somebody who has no independence or critical thought, if you create a space where they start speaking for themselves, eventually they're going to speak themselves into a corner. Eventually they're going to realize that maybe they haven't thought this through. That maybe instead of just kind of repeating what everybody says, what became, this is the woke ideology, or this is the prevalent idea. Oh, well, think for yourself. How is that possible? Is that real? That's the gift that we've given our children, and that's one of the secret gifts of Judaism. So I wish every single one of you that to focus on these beautiful gifts of just focusing on Shabbat, the gift of the weekend, just focusing on something that Napoleon knew. He knew that this was something that was so religious, and he tried to change it, but he couldn't. He couldn't make it a metric week. He had to keep it the 7-day work week. So many people have tried to uproot it, and today is a gift. And the greatest gift, the gift of independent and critical thought. Maybe not just listen. Listening is so, so hard. Even look, I mean, so many people just kind of browsing through and not taking a moment to spend this time together. There are so many people who think that they're listening, but you're listening while doing 10 other things. That's not listening. That's not being together. The gift that we have given our people for thousands of years is the gift of critical thinking, the gift of independent thought. And Hashem should bless each and every one of you, that you should be able to pass this on to your children, that you should be able to continue to tell this to the world. Because today, the world needs this more than ever. Have a wonderful, wonderful evening.
Hi, Rabbi Bernath here. I have some great news for you. My popular 4-week course, Kabbalah for Everyone, is available right now for free for the next 50 people who download it. All you have to do is go to www.theloverabbi.com, scroll to the bottom of the page, and you're going to see the download button right there. In this course, I talk about the Kabbalistic secrets to relationships, to wealth, to happiness, and balance. This special offer has been dedicated in loving memory of Ellie Dorfman. I look forward to hearing from you and hope you enjoy the course. Now on to today's episode.